From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his best-selling book, The Content of Our Character, Shelby Steele put forth a controversial view of race in America. He wrote that African Americans have built their group identity around their victimization, an identity that Steele says leads to helplessness instead of self-help. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with Shelby Steele. Also today, as the Soviet republics look to the West for economic support, we talk with Jacques Attali, the president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development. Its goal is to foster the development of democracy and market economies. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Kingsley Amis's new memoirs. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Muslim fundamentalists in Lebanon provided a photograph today of British hostage Jack Mann, along with a statement that said he was alive and well. The statement came in response to Israel's release of 51 Arab prisoners and return of the remains of 9 Lebanese guerrillas. Israel freed the prisoners after receiving information about 2 of its 7 service members missing in Lebanon. Hussein Moussaoui of the fundamentalist Hezbollah group predicted that at least some of the Western hostages will be released soon. Israel's defense ministry said today that it hopes the Arab prisoner release will help UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar in his efforts to secure the hostages' freedom. President Bush today urged patience from lawmakers seeking a $10 billion aid package to Israel, but he denied making a commitment for granting that sum of money. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush said he plans to put up a fight for his argument that consideration of a $10 billion housing loan guarantee for Israel should be delayed 120 days. He acknowledged he still has to sell the plan to some lawmakers, but he had stronger words for an unidentified Israeli spokesman who said the administration already has committed to a $10 billion figure.
There was a very misleading statement in the papers today out of Israel that I'd like to clear up, because it said this, that we were committed and they wanted what we committed to. And I'm sorry to tell you, that simply is not correct.
Mr. Bush said he is committed to providing some aid to Israel and is not looking for a confrontation with Congress. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
A new political confrontation has flared between the governments of Serbia and Croatia on the eve of the next round of the Yugoslav Peace Conference. Pierre Vickery reports the Croatian authorities have turned off a pipeline that supplies crude oil to Serbia.
For months, the Serbian and Croatian governments have been waging a tit-for-tat economic war. The Serbian government has nationalized hundreds of Croatian affiliates in Serbia, and the government in Zagreb has retaliated by garnishing Serbian assets in Croatia. This morning, the Croatian authorities announced that a pipeline supplying crude oil across Croatian territory to Serbia's 2 main refineries would be blocked, and that all oil in the pipeline would be seized as war reparations. The Serbian government went into emergency session and has threatened countermeasures unless the Yugoslav federal government forces Croatia to turn the pipeline back on. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street, with investors holding back because of what analysts say is uncertainty over the economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 4 points to close at 2,987. Declines edged advances in moderate trading on volume of about 148 million shares. This is NPR News. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee failed for a second day today to elicit the views of Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas on the issue of abortion. The judge told Senator Howard Metzenbaum that it would undermine his ability to be impartial if he were to take a position on the issue. Metzenbaum tried at least a half dozen times to get an answer from Thomas and finally said that the judge was trying to run away from views that he had expressed before his nomination. Thomas also told Senator Patrick Leahy that he had not decided whether the Roe v. Wade decision on abortion was correct. A study in today's New England Journal of Medicine offers the strongest evidence yet that women who take estrogen after menopause are less likely to get heart disease. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Estrogen treatment can be good news or bad news for postmenopausal women. On the one hand, it protects women from severe bone thinning, and it can relieve some of the discomfort of menopause. On the other hand, it can increase the risk of uterine cancer, and it may increase the risk of breast cancer, too. Today's study suggests another factor on the plus side for estrogen. Nurses taking part in a large, long-term study were half as likely to get heart disease if they took estrogen compared to women who didn't take the drug. This finding adds considerable weight to the benefits of estrogen, since cardiovascular illness kills 10 times as many women as breast cancer does. But there are still important questions about estrogen, so researchers say women and their physicians need to decide for themselves whether estrogen therapy is a good idea. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
The Cuban government reacted angrily today to Soviet President Gorbachev's announcement that he's ready to withdraw Soviet troops from Cuba. The Cuban Foreign Ministry issued a sharply worded statement noting that it was not consulted about the plan. The statement said that the number of Soviet troops on the island was far fewer than the 11,000 mentioned by Gorbachev. It said the Soviets had only a symbolic role in Cuba's defense. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The nomination of Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court has led to a wave of articles about black neoconservatives. One of the names that is always included is Shelby Steele. He's the author of the controversial bestseller, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It was first published last year and won a National Book Critics Circle Award. It just came out in paperback. In the introduction to the book, Steele acknowledges how difficult it is for blacks and whites to discuss race with each other. The things you say publicly are sometimes different from your uncensored thoughts and feelings. This book was Steele's attempt to end his own public-private racial split. The book takes the position that racism is still a barrier to black progress in America, but it's not as formidable a barrier as it once was. Steele says too many blacks put too much blame for their problems on society. There's a price they pay for this emphasis on their own victimization.
When you actually evolve an identity that's grounded in victimization, I think the effect of that is that you then grant power to change your life to the very people that you are saying victimized you in the first place. You make society, you make whites more powerful than yourself when you, again, adopt that, adopt victimization as an identity.
Now, you also write that one of the greatest problems black Americans currently face, one of the greatest barriers to development in society, is that the black memory of oppression has such power, magnitude, depth, and nuance that it constantly drains the best resources into more defense than is strictly necessary. Can I get you to elaborate on that, on how you think that oppression is draining off energy that should be channeled into other things?
Well, I think this is something that happens to any group that has been oppressed. When you begin to come out into greater freedom in society, the memory of oppression can, in effect, make you feel that that you are as oppressed now as you used to be. And so you can get a bit distorted there and exaggerate the degree of your oppression. And so then in that case, then you're defending yourself against a degree of oppression that is not real.
So do you think that the oppression of blacks in America has decreased recently?
Yes, I do. I think there's no doubt about it, which is not to say, again, that there isn't some racism left in society, some discrimination. That we obviously have to continue to be vigilant about. But clearly, looking at my own life, I can certainly see dramatic changes from the time I was a child going to segregated schools and the situation that I live in today, that my children live in.
But you say that you think a lot of blacks are reluctant to lose the status as a victim, even though there is less racism in society now than there used to be.
Yes, because I think that victimization, our history of victimization, has ironically given us the greatest power we've ever wielded in American society. It's the moral power that came from victimization that enabled us to win the victories of the Civil Rights era and to gain redress from society. And so since that has been our power source, we've been reluctant to move on and develop other power sources. And I think what we've in fact done is revolve our entire identity around that victimization, so that the poor black is the true black. The higher you climb in society, then the more marginal you become. You're an Oreo. You're You're a sellout. Colin Powell's blackness I hear questioned a good deal, but I never hear the blackness of a crack dealer in Harlem questioned. So we have, again, victimization is what authenticates the black identity today.
Well, you're right, as a middle-class black, that you've often found yourself contriving to be black. What's an example of that?
Well, again, that goes back to this victim-focused identity that has emerged over the last 25 years. So that if you are the only way that, and people, of course, accuse Shelby Steele of not being black all the time. So if I want to prove that I am black, the first thing I have to do is point to some instance in my life where I was victimized. I have to say, well, I went to segregated schools. I grew up in an all-black segregated community. And that appeases people. Say, well, okay, then maybe he is black, or maybe he used to be black. In other words, black becomes equated with victimization. And so when I say contriving to be black, what I've got to do is again, claim a degree of victimization in my life that may or may not be there. But in order to authenticate myself as being black, then I've got to somehow point to victimization.
As you write in your book, you're middle class, you're a college professor, you live in a white suburb, your children go to schools where they're the only blacks in their classes, and your wife is white. How do you think that's affected your credibility among different groups of blacks and whites? Do you think that is something that affects your credibility in the eyes of some of your critics?
Well, I have no doubt that it does. Again, on the other hand, I remain black, no matter where I live, no matter who I'm married to. And so my experience is a black one. And my point in the book is that there are millions of other blacks like me. All blacks do not live in the ghetto, only with other black people. The black race is a very various race, and our experience is various and different. And so my experience, this is my point. What makes me black is not my victimization. It's not even my proximity to one race or another. It is simply the fact that I'm black.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Shelby Steele, who's author of the bestseller, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It just came out in paperback, and Steele is a professor of English at San Jose State University. You think that affirmative action has actually done more harm than good in the United States. Why do you think that?
Well, again, it's a phrase where it qualifies more harm than good. I don't say affirmative action never helped anybody. I just think that we've come to a point where by affirmative action here, I'm talking about the use of racial preferences, whereby standards are actually lowered so that minorities or one group or another can gain admission to a workplace, to universities, and so forth. When you do lower the standard in order to prefer a given group, you inevitably stigmatize that group with inferiority, which is precisely the stigma that blacks have fought 250 years to try to get out from under. So in a sense, affirmative action allows the society to reenact racism.
Let me get to what some of your critics have had to say about your book, The Content of Our Character. Now, Stephen Carter, who's a Yale law professor and author of the new book, Confessions of an Affirmative Action Baby, has this to say. Steele suggests that racism is receding, and he's partly correct. It's no longer the all-encompassing force it once was. What Steele misses is that racism, in its many modern varieties, continues to operate with awesome force in the lives of many of the worst-off members of our community.
I disagree with him. I think that what's operating in the lives of the worst-off members of our community is the chronic cycle of poverty and all of the disorientation and despair that goes along with that. I don't think racism per se is the problem of teenage welfare mothers. I mean, they're not in a situation where they're interacting enough with the mainstream to be the victims of racism. They're the victims of possibly the legacy of historic racism. Certainly they're the victims of that. But today they're now victims of these deeply entrenched patterns of poverty that you can see in any poor community.
Well, let me continue with what Stephen Carter writes. He says, although racist oppression might no longer be an important barrier, what might be described as racist indifference still rears its ugly head. And he says, even if, as Steele suggests, there are few effective barriers to advancement for the talented, there may be barriers to the acquisition of talent, and the barriers increasingly run along class lines.
Well, then he ought to really blame it on class, because then that's the problem, and I think that that is a serious problem. But poor people of any race do not have the same opportunities to develop their talents as middle-class people do. He's, I think, blurring the race and class and poverty and everything else and subsuming it under the category of race, and I think he ought to be more careful in his distinctions.
Let me share one of my reservations. You raise really interesting points about the position especially of middle-class black Americans who haven't faced the degree of racism and oppression of the past and who also aren't necessarily black in the stereotypes that even some black people hold about what being black means. But it seems to me you've kind of elevated this to an ideology, and you've made it seem that if blacks stop identifying as oppressed and stop blaming mainstream culture for their oppression, that, poof, they'll just succeed. All obstacles will be gone, and if they just apply themselves, success awaits. I mean, wouldn't you agree that there really are just a lot of other obstacles that are kind of inherent within the social and economic system now?
Absolutely. I'd never say otherwise. I think, frankly, that it's tougher for blacks. And I think racism is one of the reasons it's tougher for blacks today. But it's a cruel and it's an unjust fate. I think people look for fairness where fairness is impossible. The point is, we're still suffering from the fate of slavery and so forth. But what is the answer? To give up? To take our ball and go home? I think that our only chance is to even though it may be tougher, is to continue to fight, to use initiative, and to help ourselves. Because obviously, the history of America indicates that there's not a great deal of willingness or even capacity in the part of the larger society to really help us.
Shelby Steele is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Shelby Steele, and he's the author of the controversial book, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It's a bestseller that just came out in paperback. He's also a professor at the San Jose State University. You write that you were caught up in the Black Power movement in the 1960s. What changed your point of view about Black Power? Why were you a part of it, and what later alienated you from it?
Well, I was a part of it because for the reasons probably that many people were. I was very angry, and you don't really feel your anger until you begin to sort of sniff freedom and get a bit of freedom, and then you realize what you did endure. And again, in the mid-60s, after the civil rights legislation and so forth, and there was a greater degree of freedom, that was really the first time that I certainly, on a visceral level, began to experience the anger at what had been done to me and to other black people. And I think that the Black Power movement that began to come about at that point in time was in many ways, among other things, an expression of that anger. And I think it was a very necessary and absolutely inevitable process. There's no way to come out of a situation like that without a lot of anger that has to be dispelled. And I think a lot of that anger is still around today.
So what changed your mind about the Black Power?
Well, I began to realize that its function really was anger, the dissipation of anger. And as time went on in the early 70s, it became clear to me that I was going to have to live down here on the ground in American society like other people, that I'd have to get a job and raise a family and buy a house and pay a car note, and that Black Power wasn't going to do that for me, that I would have to find ways to do that in society on my own. And so you simply grow up and you understand that you can't linger in that anger, that regardless of what's happened, it became clear to me that the best way to move forward was to become a part of the mainstream.
Stephen Carter has a new book called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby, and he writes about how he knows he's been the beneficiary of the benefits of affirmative action, yet he's very ambivalent about affirmative action. And I wonder if you feel the same way, if you've ever felt like you were the beneficiary of any of that, even though you're very critical of it.
Well, I came along just before there was a lot of affirmative action, certainly in terms of college admissions and that kind of thing. I was still sort of the era where I met some more resistance than preference. And I can't really look to too many instances in my own career where I think that's had much of an effect. You know, I think it's a little indulgent to worry too much about whether you have you've benefited or not. Again, I think if you have, then fine. I think the important thing is to move forward. And in any case, whether you've benefited or not, that's really not a justification of the policy.
As we speak now, the Senate Judiciary Committee is in the middle of confirmation hearings on Clarence Thomas. What's your take on him?
I admire Clarence Thomas enormously, and again, he represents certainly many of the values that that I've talked about. Here's somebody who, and people say, well, his life story, his rags to riches story, should not be an element in whether he sits on the court or not, and I pretty much agree with that. On the other hand, I think it does say a great deal about the man's character, and certainly as a role model for blacks, I think he has much to offer. Again, he indicates, as I try to do in my book, how it is actually done, how one actually does move forward in this society. And one of the legacies of our 250 years of oppression is that when we came out of it in the 60s, we didn't know very much about how it was done, about what buttons to push and so forth and to move forward in American life. In slavery, all the values of initiative and self-reliance were conditioned away from blacks. In 1938, a black was lynched for painting his house. Well, you can hardly develop the attitudes and values that it takes to thrive in freedom under those kinds of circumstances. That's the challenge that faces us today, precisely the challenge. And Clarence Thomas, I feel, is a superb role model in that regard.
Well, you want a Supreme Court justice to be more than a positive role model. What do you think
you
know of his legal record?
Well, of his legal record, again, I certainly am not a constitutional scholar or anything, but what I have read of his decisions, for example, his criticism of Brown versus Board of Education, which I thought was an interesting criticism, and other things, I found fascinating and original. I have talked to him at different times over the years and find him to be very, very much his own man, a very independent thinking person. And my feeling is, and I'm just a lay person in this regard, but my feeling is that he's going to leave a mark on the court.
You know, I think that a lot of people who would have strongly opposed him had he been white were less comfortable opposing him because he was black, and they would really like to see a black Supreme Court justice. They would also like to see somebody in there who was perceived as more liberal than he is. Do you think that race should have been an issue in this, and what ways do you think it has been?
No, I mean, I think that that's a little, that's wishful thinking. I mean, we have a Republican president, and a conservative president. Obviously, he's going to appoint somebody who's conservative. So to then say, well, I wish he was liberal, it seems to me to be wishful thinking. I don't think race really has much to do with that.
You have often been referred to as a black neoconservative. Do you think that that's an accurate label insofar as any label is ever accurate?
No, I resent it. I don't think of myself as a neoconservative. I think I probably support 90% of what would be considered a liberal agenda on race. The problem is, if you ever mention the principle of self-reliance in regard to black problems, you are automatically a conservative. You can support social programs all day long, but if you mention self-help or self-reliance, then you are blaming the victim, you are against blacks, and you are conservative. So that's the litmus test. That's where that label comes from. And again, it has more to do, I think, with the limited terms by which we discuss race in America than anything to do with me.
I've heard some people criticize you for having moved to a white suburb and who have interpreted that as a kind of abandoning of black culture and black people. What's your response to that? What kind of pressures, what kind of like group pressures do you feel are put on successful blacks like yourself that you think are unfair?
Well, that's unfair. In every way. The middle class of any race tries to get into a neighborhood where the schools are at least halfway decent, where their property values are reasonable, and so forth. This is absolutely inevitable. It's necessary. The problem that I say, and many of my friends in situations like me, is that why in the heck aren't you coming to join me here? You can't expect people in life to move backward. We move forward. We move up. No one wants to take their children and put them in an environment where there's violence and there's drugs. And what would that gain? On the other hand, what I think those people also need to understand, because often the accusation is that, well, if you live, if you're not living in the black community, then you're isolated. Quite the opposite. I was called a nigger 2 weeks ago in a parking lot. That's the kind of, because it is precisely because I am in the larger community that I probably run into 10 times more racism than anybody who lives in the ghetto runs into. So my black experience in the sense of victimization never leaves me, never will.
And you don't mean that in the sense to play up your role as victim, right?
No, and I don't want to wade around in my victimization. No, because I have to keep going, whether he calls me a nigger or not, don't I? I've got to live life, and I'll be damned if I'm going to let him make that into an identity for me. The problem is really his.
Well, Shelby Steele, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Shelby Steele is the author of The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. It's just come out in paperback. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. the past 70 years, the Soviet economy has been rigidly controlled and regulated by a centralized power. But now that's all changing. Coming up, Jacques Attali, the president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, tells us what's at stake for the West in the Soviet push toward a market economy. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan tells us why she can't stand the English writer Kingsley Amis, but why she loves his new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Jessica Berman. Judge Clarence Thomas faced aggressive questioning by members of the Senate Judiciary Committee today, the second day of hearings on Thomas's nomination to be an associate justice on the Supreme Court. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Thomas was pressed again today on his views about a woman's constitutional right to abortion. And again today, he refused to answer questions about the issue. Ohio Democrat Howard Metzenbaum pointed out that Thomas was very specific about his judicial philosophy when asked about a whole range of issues, but that he still refused to talk about abortion. But Thomas didn't budge. He repeated that he would not compromise his impartiality by answering questions about abortion, and he assured the committee he had no personal agenda and would come to decisions on cases about abortion with an open mind. The abortion issue will likely come up again and again throughout the remainder of Thomas's testimony, which is expected to continue until Friday. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Former Defense Secretary and Washington power broker Clark Clifford today denied any wrongdoing in the scandal surrounding BCCI, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, and its secret takeover of Washington's largest bank. NPR's Elaine Corey reports.
The House Banking Committee today explored how the foreign-owned BCCI was able to control First American Bank for 9 years before being discovered. The lead witnesses were Clark Clifford, First American's former chairman, and Robert Altman, its one-time president. The two attorneys, who also represented BCCI, repeatedly told lawmakers they never knew the outlaw bank had secretly bought a majority interest in First American. And they denied charges that BCCI ever controlled the Washington Bank's operations. Many committee members were frankly skeptical of the testimony. Charles Schumer, a New York Democrat, told Clifford,
"My heart wants to believe you. My head says no."
On Friday, the committee will ask bank regulators why it took them so long to uncover the fraud. I'm Elaine Corey in Washington.
Authorities in Eagle Pass, Texas, are trying to figure out what caused today's crash of a Continental Airlines commuter plane. The aircraft was on its way to Houston from Laredo when it went down in a cornfield. All 11 passengers, two crew members, and a flight attendant were killed. A witness reported that the aircraft exploded in midair, but that's not been confirmed. The plane was checked in May, and no problems were found after the same make and model crashed in Brunswick, Georgia, last April, killing among its passengers former Texas Senator John Tower. A 17-year-old boy armed with a shotgun held 22 students hostage for more than 4 hours at a Rapid City, South Dakota high school today. The standoff ended without injury. Police have no motives. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today with the Dow Jones Industrial Average gaining 4 points to close at 2987.03. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington. Cuba reacted angrily today to news that the Soviets plan to withdraw their troops from the Caribbean island nation. In a sharply worded foreign ministry statement, Cuba said it was not even consulted about the decision. The statement also said the number of Soviet troops on the island was far fewer than the 11,000 Moscow said it was removing, and that their role was only symbolic. In Beirut, a group that says it holds British hostage Jack Mann says he's alive and well, and that the release of prisoners by Israel had raised hopes of a happy ending for Western hostages. The statement was accompanied by a color picture of Mann, a former pilot who has been missing since May 12, 1989. No group had previously claimed his abduction. In Mexico, nearly 24 cases of cholera have been reported in the capital city, despite official claims that the disease had not spread to Mexico City. Sandina Robbins reports.
Health officials now admit that 21 people are being treated for cholera in Mexico City and that one person has died. Nationwide, more than 800 cases have been diagnosed since June, causing at least 11 deaths. Many health workers charge the government with a cover-up to prevent loss of revenue from tourism and exports. Others claim the low death toll is due to a weaker strain of the cholera bacteria than the one which has caused 3,000 deaths in South America this year. While Mexican health authorities insist there is no danger of an epidemic here, health workers say widespread unsanitary conditions could allow cholera to spread quickly. For National Public Radio, I'm Sandina Robbins in Mexico City.
A large AIDS conference will be held next year in Amsterdam. The conference has been moved from Boston in protest of U.S. immigration policies on AIDS patients. The annual International Conference on AIDS had been scheduled for next May in Boston. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Maureen Corrigan has a review of a new book that she says can compete with Kitty Kelly's biography of Nancy Reagan for the honor of being the most libelous book of 1991. It's an autobiography by British novelist Kingsley Amis called Memoirs. Amis's novels, such as Lucky Jim and The Old Devils, are celebrated for their droll wit and for their irreverence towards academics, politicians, writers, and other cultural icons. This time, Amis trains his jaundiced eye on his own life.
Kingsley Amis is a misogynist, a right-wing conservative, and a snob. Actually, I should refer to him as Sir Kingsley Amis, because in 1990, he was knighted by Queen Elizabeth. In the cover photo on his new book, Memoirs, Sir Kingsley looks the part of an old, debauched knight. His smile is positively gin-pickled, his body run to fat and encased in tweeds. You tend to believe him when he confesses that the Queen and Maggie Thatcher are his dream girls. On the face of it, Kingsley Amis wouldn't seem to be my kind of writer. His notion of how to develop female characters begins and ends with a description of what he calls their knockers. But in truth, I've read a fair amount of his fiction. You see, even though Kingsley Amis may be a reactionary sod these days, back in 1954, he was sort of an angry young man, and he wrote a book called Lucky Jim. It's the funniest novel ever written in English. Lucky Jim is about a lower middle class guy named Jim Dixon who lands a job teaching history at a British university. In order to cope with the pomposity of his academic colleagues, he drinks a lot. Here's Amis's description of Jim Dixon's mouth the morning after a binge. His mouth had been used as a latrine by some small creature of the night, and then as its mausoleum. I keep hoping that once before he dies, Amis will write another novel filled with sentences like that. The memoirs are a near miss. They're no Lucky Jim, but they are funnier than any of the fiction Amis has written in the intervening 37 years. Amis doesn't exactly bare his soul here. He's silent on the subject of his two failed marriages, his children, and his own books. What Amis does do, hilariously, is get even. He uses the memoirs to avenge himself on every moocher who ever stuck him with a bar tab and every bore who ever sat beside him on an airplane. Neither the great, nor the small, nor the illustrious dead are spared. Take, for instance, Dylan Thomas. Amis remembers the poet as an outstandingly unpleasant man who cheated and stole from his friends and peed on their carpets. Fans of the late children's author Roald Dahl should skip the chapter where Amis recalls meeting Dahl at a party. According to Amis, Dahl urged him to write a children's book because that's where the money is. Then Dahl proceeded to refer to his pint-sized, adoring readers by a nasty name I can't say on radio. Amis goes beyond the personal here to attack entire civilizations. He has no use for the city of Prague because he says it has the heaviest general concentration of body odor I have ever come across. And he flatly dismisses almost the entire canon of American literature as a disaster. Well, that should be sufficient to give you the general tone of Amis's memoirs, cranky, offensive, and wickedly funny. Too bad Amis has fossilized into the kind of arch-conservative he once lampooned in Lucky Jim. But at least in his memoirs, Amis has rediscovered his wonderful gift for puncturing pretension. And for that, I can forgive him almost anything.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Memoirs by Kingsley Amis. This is Fresh Air. Yesterday, Mikhail Gorbachev appealed to the West for economic aid to support the Soviet Union's transformation into a great Eurasian democracy. My guest, Jacques Attali, is the head of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, a new institution created by the European Community to direct money to projects in Eastern Europe and Central Europe which promote democracy and market economies. The bank has also been working in Moscow on a food distribution program. Attali is a former special advisor to French President François Mitterrand and a former economics professor. He's visiting the States to meet with officials of the World Bank and the IMF. The trip coincides with the American publication of his book Millennium, Winners and Losers in the Coming World Order. I asked Attali to tell us what's at stake for Europe as communism falls and the former communist countries face an uncertain future.
The main issue is now how to stabilize the eastern part of Europe in order to avoid the proliferation of nuclear weapons and overwhelming amount of migrants coming from the eastern part of Europe, as United States faced in the past with Mexico and Latin America, not with a question of nuclear weapons, but with a question of migrants. And then when people are calling, saying about why do we need to pay for the mistakes of communism, I would say that it is in our own interest to see that succeed, not only because we have to be afraid of it, but also because it's a tremendous chance for the world to see the size of Europe doubling and creating a new market of 400 million people more.
I know that the European Bank would like to see the Soviets head more toward a market economy and a democratic direction. So what kind of programs do you think are best to invest in the Soviet republics to help foster market economy and democracy?
First, to help them create the institutions that are needed for market economy and democracy to function, which are laws, parliaments, judiciary system, banks, patent rights, and etc. Second, organize the development of export-earning industrial sectors like oil and gas in order to help them create a more stabilized balance of payment. And then after that, push the creation of joint ventures with the private sector in order to move in the good direction.
What kind of case does a republic or a country have to make to you before your bank gives them the money?
We are not a window where people can come and get money. We work with a country as member of a bank to establish with him his strategy for transition to democracy and market economy. We work with him globally in order to assist them in shaping the doctrine of their transition to market economy and to democracy. We help setting the doctrine of that transition. And within the framework of that doctrine, we help them create opportunities for specific operations like the development of telecom or airport or railroads or specific projects. We don't give money to an anonymous bureaucracy.
You know, it's really interesting to me. The Cold War seemed to be this war between capitalism and communism, and it would seem that capitalism won, right? So even though there's a lot that's falling apart in capitalism. But anyways, in talking about restructuring the Soviet Union, we're talking about a market economy. Nobody's using the word the Soviet Union's going to become capitalist. They're talking about market economy. What does it say to you that that's the word we're using instead of, maybe in France the language is different, but in the United States they're talking market economy, not capitalism.
I think it's wise. I think it's wise because market economy means institutions. Where the laws are our market. Capitalism was the word that was used against socialism or by socialists against communism. And then I think it's wise to get rid of both words, communism and capitalism, because both words were in a vocabulary of war, ideological war. I prefer the more neutral words, market economy.
What about the word socialist? You were part of a socialist government in France. How do you feel about the meaning of the word socialism now?
Well, I think the word is not dead. Social democracy in Europe, in a lot of countries, is still a hope. And if you want to have a market economy and a democracy, because a market economy without a democracy means something like a Pinochet type of regime, which is another nightmare. If we want to have both market economy and democracy, you cannot have democracy if you don't have at least a two-party system. Two-party system means a left and a right. And how do you call the left? Do you call it liberal? Do you call it Democrats? Do you call it socialist or social democrats? It's always the same vision, which is the fact that you have to put countervailing powers within the built-in the market institutions in order to protect the weakest. This is clearly needed for democracy.
Now, I think some people would assume that the fall of communism would discredit socialism. Do you think that that's fair?
I don't think it's fair. I don't think it's fair. But time will decide what are the words which will be used in the future. There is a filter with time for words. It's very interesting to see that communism and, as you said, rightly, capitalism, too, are words that look awkward today. We'll see what happened to socialism or social democrat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jacques Attali. He's the president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, and he's former special advisor to French President Mitterrand. Now, you grew up in Algeria till
yes.
you were, what, around 10 or something?
11, yes.
Yeah, and your father was a merchant.
Mm-hmm.
What did he do?
Perfume.
He sold perfume?
Yes.
And I was wondering, since your father, I guess it's fair to say, was a really successful capitalist, not I don't want to rely too much on these divisions, but it seems to me in your own way you kind of headed away from that. What set you off in a different direction politically? Am I making unfair assumptions here?
No, I mean, I think it's not the way things move. My family, my father went out of his own background and make a fair success in his business. But he always was very left-oriented in terms of politics and mainly pushing children to go to school and become scholars. Do you know what that means? That word means scholars, intellectuals, academicians. And I was bound to do that. And in order to be free to think and to think from scratch without any commitment, then no one is either black or white or never left or right. I am a free thinker, free of choosing and free of changing my mind.
One of the concerns now in what's happening in the Soviet Union is ethnic fighting and the rise of nationalism and how that's going to affect ethnic minorities within mm-hmm, the countries. Mm-hmm. As someone who's Jewish, I wonder if you're really worried about a rise of anti-Semitism.
Well, in my book, I explain that we are in a world where the word nomadism is going to be the core of culture in the future, both because the technology of the future is going to push towards more portable goods, and second, because the values are going to be pushing people to be more nomads, more lonely and more delinked to their roots. That's why I really think that we enter a world where migrations will be enormous. Anti-Semitism is another thing. I just published in France another book about the history of the year 1492, which is a very interesting year, not only because of the discovery of America, but because of the expulsion of Jews and Muslims from Europe. And from that we learn that Europe has always been trying to get rid of his past. And his past means to choose his own father, trying to forget that his father was Jewish and that his past was in Jerusalem and not in Rome. Anti-Semitism is a way of rewriting history, rewriting past. I think now we can hope that in the future people in Europe will try to be free enough to live with their own past, whatever it was. And that my dream is not to avoid migration, but to see that a Jewish or a Tzigan or a Russian or even a French can live wherever he wants in Europe. Freely and welcome.
Are you expecting that there will be a big wave of immigration from the Soviet Union and from the newly independent republics, immigration to Europe.
This is both a danger and a chance. This is certainly a danger because if we assist to an evolution where 40 million people are going to be unemployed, it's a danger. But it's also a chance, and I don't want to see migration as a problem. After all, United States is a country where people coming from all parts of Europe build here a new nation. And we have not to be afraid of mixing Ukrainians, Jews, Polish, Dutch or Germans and English. This is exactly what United States is about. In a way, we can say that it's the only really European country. Then I hope that in the future, Europe also will accept that mixed. But of course, it has to be on a stable way and not one way. Path, but two-way street by having French going to Moscow and Polish going to Dublin.
What do you think the chances of that would be?
Well, it's up to us. It's not a matter of chance. It's a matter of will.
You think a lot of French people would want to move to the Soviet Union?
To Russia? Why not? To work? To create? Why not? Future is based upon tolerance and creation. And it certainly will be linked to the acceptance of a new world of exchanges. Don't think about Europe as in the past. Europe is a continent of 700 neighbors, and I hope not distant neighbors.
How do you like living in such exciting times and having so much responsibility during it? I don't know if you expected that you'd be heading up a European bank at just the time that the Soviet Union collapsed with all these really huge, important decisions to be made.
No, it's fascinating to be in a position to create an international institution because this institution has been created in the last 18 months. And I was at the beginning of the idea and the launching of that. And it's interesting to have an idea and to see that becoming reality. And for an academician and a scholar to see that ideas can become reality, something which is quite interesting, knowing that I try to live also by taking a lot of time to think, to write, to read, in order not to lose my vision in two short-term decisions.
Do you feel like you personally thrive on this kind of excitement? Are you anxious for things to calm down a little bit?
No, I hope they will never come down.
Why?
Well, it's time enough to rest in another world.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jacques Attali is the president of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development and the author of the new book Millennium, Winners and Losers in the Coming World Order. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on the second day of Clarence Thomas' hearing?
Well, we'll have a report from Mara Liasson about several members of the committee tangling with Judge Thomas about his views on abortion, what he meant by his remarks about natural law. Once again, Judge Thomas, as he did yesterday, has avoided making any clear statement of what he believes about abortion. In fact, he says that when he became a judge, he stopped having or acquiring strong opinions about things. I will also be talking with NPR's Nina Totenberg, who's following those hearings, and reports also on the administration's positions on loan guarantees for Israel and what those loan guarantees actually amount to.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. When the question is asked, who's writing songs about today in the tradition of Cole Porter and Frank Lesser, an answer you're likely to hear is Dave Frischberg. Earlier today, I had the pleasure of recording a studio concert with this songwriter, pianist, and singer. We'll broadcast the concert tomorrow. But Frischberg played more good music than we'll have time for. So here's a tune you won't hear tomorrow that will give you a sense of what's to come. This is Dave Frischberg in the Fresh Air studio playing his song, I Was Ready.
I was ready. Like a battleship at Pearl Harbor, I was steady, like a shave with a part-time barber. I was green. Need I tell you that isn't easy? But I was happy, not to mention grumpy and sneezy. I was like a cue ball straight for the pocket. But I had no doubt just how things would turn out to be. I was sure and I was certain, but romance rang down the curtain. I was ready for her, but she wasn't ready for me. I was ready, like a goose that's cooked to perfection. But I was open for a left to the low midsection. I'd been through it like a plumber who cleans the drains out. But I blew it when the good Lord passed all the brains out. I was ready, just like Oswald was ready for Ruby, like Mikhail Gorbachev was prepared for the KGB. I was poised and well prepared, but who knew, and what's more, who cared? I was ready for her, Nelson Eddy for her. I was ready for her, but she wasn't ready for me. She wasn't ready for me.
Dave Frischberg with us doing one of his originals. You've updated the song. You took out the Michael Dukakis reference and put in Gorbachev.
That's right. It was the least I could do.
That's Dave Frischberg recorded earlier today in our studio. We'll hear the rest of the concert tomorrow on Fresh Air. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audie Voblaitis, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Words and Music by Dave Frischberg. We have a concert with one of today's wittiest songwriters, who also happens to be a great pianist. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.